The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Good morning. Today I'll be giving some perspectives on justice, and the sub-theme I've given to it is a personal journey in the jungle of injustice. I'm here with my wife at the back and my daughter. We know that historically the church had been at the forefront of fighting for justice, of course, beginning with the church in the Old Testament, if we might call it that. And then we see how in the 19th century, Christians had a great impact on bringing about justice in society in the United Kingdom. Many of us know about the work of William Wilberforce and the Clapham Club. But towards the end of that century, we find more and more Christian people moving who were involved with social justice, neglecting the gospel, the evangelistic aspect of the gospel, which has been termed the Great Betrayer. And from that time into the early 20th century, those who were fervent about evangelism neglected the social aspect or implications of the gospel, which again led to what has been called the Great Reversal. And much of the 20th century, evangelical Christians had neglected that aspect. So it's very heartwarming to see an institution like Westminster getting back into these issues. As a person, I became acutely aware of injustice at the age of 7. When growing up in my family, where my dad was a polygamist, and because of the injustice, the nature of the unjust nature of that type of marriage, myself and my siblings suffered a lot of things. One thing that brought that to my mind vividly was that at the age of 7. I had to begin to work to earn money to buy my own clothes. And subsequent other things I saw within that context. And therefore, all through my life, that has been an issue that tugs at my heart. Now, just to give, say, a biblical background to this so that we can recognize injustice, I would like to say that a contemporary idea of justice, or social justice if you want, but justice alone is more encompassing, can be derived from so many biblical passages, which we don't have time for that, but the key concepts of mishpat and tzedakah in the Old Testament capture these ideas very well. Mishpat, for instance, inherently has the idea of judicial activism consisting in either the provision of standard criteria for conduct and or adjudication, and additionally the actual arbitration between parties with the goal of ascertaining culpability and or otherwise, and administering the requisite sanctions or acquittal. Tzedakah, on the other hand, emphasizes established norm as just order for right conduct, both in the larger society and for individuals. So, oftentimes in the Bible, we find these two terms used in combination as a word pair or hendides, in which case the emphasis is on the inherent requirement for conformity to established norm, whether it is in the religious sphere, which we tend to emphasize as Christian people, or in civil society. So that these issues in the requirement for loyalty or right conduct between individuals as well. Now, for a more clearer definition of this for society today, we can turn to such documents as the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights or the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. So what I just gave about my own experience relates to the Convention on the Rights of a Child and to the constitutions of national governments, modern democracies. Having said that, then I will go on to give a few examples of what I have called the jungle of injustice that I experienced as a person. Now, I will show this at the level of the family, the institution, the community, and the state, and perhaps even the international community, if I can do that within a limited time. Now, at the family, I gave one example of my dad not providing for us because of the situation of the polygamous family. And one other example of that was at that age of 7, when I started elementary school, the first day of school, I went up to my dad and asked for money so I can buy lunch at school. And it was literally a single penny at that time. And he told me, you know, if I want to go to school, I should never ask him for money again. If I want to eat food, I should stay at home. That's the choice I had. And I had to go to school on an empty stomach and stay there till about 2 o'clock when I would come back. Now, that leads to an example of injustice in an institution. As I was going to school, this elementary school, we had mango trees within the school. And one day, during afternoon recess, I sat at the roots of the mango tree very hungry. And one of the teachers asked the bigger students who climbed the tree, plucked so many mangoes he and his friend were eating. And myself and another child, I guess that he also had no money for lunch, so he was sitting there with me. And this teacher asked us to be gathering the mangoes for him. There was a very big pile. And he never gave us one. So I was too hungry. I took one and began to eat. And he was very angry and asked me to throw it away. When I didn't, he came and snatched it and threw it away. When he finished eating, he asked me to come and pack the peelings that he had left over. And I refused that I was going to do it. And he spanked me. Schools back home spank students to this day. He spanked me, and I told him even if he spanked me, I wasn't going to pack it. So to make sure that I packed it, he had to grab my hands and grab the dirt and took it to the trash heap. So we were doing it together. But that's how, as a 7-year-old kid, I began to resist injustice. Now, another example of a family situation is my sister's friend. Her husband died. He had quite some means. And I guess probably he never left a will. And naturally, the relatives came and took everything, took the wife as well. They went for burial. Why? She was overwhelmed. She wasn't very educated. And so she was just overwhelmed with grief. And while she was grieving, the husband's relatives went to the bank accounts, cleared everything, took all the resources, and went with it. And the one who was in charge decided that he was also going to acquire the wife. And as a believer, she didn't want to do that. And once she refused to become an addition to his number of wives, he sent her out with not a single penny and with 5 kids to take care of. At the communal level, We have situations where one community is engaged in fighting another. But at other times, I've shared here about the sufferings of Christians from Muslims. Nigeria has a population of Muslims, Christians. In the north, it's mostly Muslims. In the south, it's mostly Christians. And the Christians in the north are greatly persecuted. It's one of the most persecuted churches in the world. Take, for instance, during the riots about the Dennis cartoons, I think 2 years ago, the greatest number of people killed in that riot was in Nigeria, 48 people. So if you take the totals around the world of people who died because of that cartoon, they don't make up to one-third of the number that died in Nigeria. So there's that kind of injustice at community level. Now, at state level, there's a relative of mine, Mrs. David, who had worked in government, became a director general of a government department. And for 8 years now, Nigeria has been experimenting with democracy after many years of military rule. And historically, in Nigeria, public servants were meant to be apolitical. And so, but with the current experiment, the current politicians have been trying to get them more and more involved in politics. And so this woman is more of the old school type person. And so during the electioneering campaign, when government officials were being used to rig elections massively, she refused to participate on the basis of her faith as a Christian. And because of that, she lost her job. Now, another case is what I call the Zaki Biam genocide. I will show you some clips. They're very disturbing. When I am showing that, if there's any child here, I would like the parent to take them out. But there was an army chief of staff who happened to come from the same ethnic group as myself during this same civil democracy experience. And there was a very major policy disagreement between him and the president. And he decided to resign and go public about that. And the president felt very insulted and felt he decided to deal with him. And to deal with him, at that time, there was some of the local disagreements, and the president exploited that on the pretext that there was a fighting in this general's local area, and some people were killed, and soldiers were sent, and the soldiers were killed, which was not true because the government claimed there were 19 soldiers killed. They did a state funeral for them, but not a single name of those soldiers was named. Not a single family member was interviewed by the press or put forward by anybody so that they can know it was true. But he decided to send in troops who killed, maimed, killed people, destroyed property. And my youngest sister was living in that area doing some local business. For 3 days that the military was operating there, many of them who escaped with their lives were in the bush hiding for 3 days, not eating anything, sleeping, you know, at the risk of snakes. And many people were killed by snakes in the bushes. The strange thing is that military oppression was being done with equipment supplied by your tax money because of U.S. military assistance to Nigeria, helicopter gunships being used on civilians that were unarmed. Please take her out. Let me show the pictures. So in view of all this, what are the possible ways or steps of ensuring justice? I'll go over this very quickly, and perhaps at another opportunity I could expand a little bit more on this. But one is creating the enabling environment for justice to thrive. And having stayed in America for 7 years now, I've come to understand why democracies work in the West. because these enabling environments are there. And if they are not there, merely holding an election is not democracy. And this is what many Western countries don't understand. So once there is an election, they conclude there is democracy, but it's a lie. You have to have an educated populace that will be able to know their rights, know their civic responsibilities, and to be able to defend, you know, their rights. Secondly, you must build a viable judicial system that guarantees enforceable justice. This incident that happened recently, the people from that area took the government to court, and they won a case whereby they were awarded about $400 million damages. But would they be able to get that from government? It's not likely. So if you can't get enforceable justice, it's not worth the while. And thirdly, economic empowerment. Ecclesiastes 10:19 says something to the effect of money is the answer to everything, you know, and which in a sense Ecclesiastes was talking about the world's philosophy, and we are dealing with the world. And so when people are more economically empowered, they stand less chance of being humiliated or their rights downtrodden. Now, this is an area in which we've seen some people who maybe we will even think we know better than them, but are working very hard. People like Bono of U2 and Richard Curtis. Especially these two have, in 2006, were able to obtain billions of debt forgiveness for African countries from the Club of Seven most advanced countries. I think they are blazing the trail that we as Christians need to follow. Secondly, to building those structures, we also need to demolish the structures that perpetuate division and rivalry. And in the African context, this has to do with things like tribalism and interfaith conflicts. And of course, even here, we don't escape that. You know, we can see ethnicity arising in the current political climate as well. Thirdly, we need to redevelop and strengthen and work towards sustaining subsidiarity. Most African cultures were sustained by subsidiarity groups. But over time, as we have been becoming more and more Westernized, that structure of subsidiarity is also disappearing. But those were the structures that ensured the economic well-being and social justice within the community. So the church has that responsibility of helping people in the new emerging communities to still build and sustain subsidiarity groups. And that could be done by also building civil society institutions. And we are beginning to have more of this, say, in Nigeria, in the secular arena. But they are coming from a secular humanistic perspective. And that's where the Christian perspective to nonprofit work becomes very important, because you are not just addressing, you know, the outward form of man, but the totality of his being. So, and I think this is where I would say there is the need for changing our perspectives on missions, so that, because missions, just like AIDS in the secular government structure, tends to focus on the symptoms rather than dealing with the crux of the issues. So I am suggesting a model that I call more of constructive engagement. And you can see many of the new emerging economies today are have been achieving that, not so much because there was AIDS. Some of them received AIDS, but beyond AIDS, there was constructive engagement of the West with those economies. Take South Korea, for instance. After the war, there was massive aid from US, but at the same time, there was constructive engagement in terms of investments in those economies. The same goes for China. China had been receiving food aids from the 60s until 3 years ago. But the turn of China's economy began when the West began to invest in China, beginning from the 80s. So if we focus on only sending aid to Africa, Africa will continue to remain where it is. But we need to turn towards constructive engagement. There are lots of investment opportunities in Africa. And I think even as Christians, there is the need for even changing the way we do missions, not completely doing away with the old model, but more of seeing professional and business-inclined people moving to some of these areas and setting up shops in a varied in the marketplace as the launching pad for missions. And you will be very profitable at the same time being available to the gospel. I hope that sometimes we can talk more about this, but thank you very much for this opportunity.